This is episode number 773 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Guardians of the Galaxy 3 and Wizard World. Our comics this week will be X-Men Blue number 1, Booster Gold The Flintstones, Weapon X number 1, and Green Lantern Space Ghost. And our creator spotlight this week is Jeffrey Edwards, the artist on the upcoming Warlock 5 series, who I spoke to recently about the new Kickstarter to bring back that book.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm excited, Matthew.
Yes.
I'm excited because we have comic books to talk about. We have news to talk about, and there was some good news this week. And that news is starting off with our friend James Gunn. Because James Gunn is going to come back and direct the Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Now, of course, we know that I believe it's May 2nd. Is that when Guardians 2 comes out? One of those dates, yep. Matthew. Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is impending. It's coming.
It's coming.
Very soon. But there was a lot of question about whether or not, A, there would be a Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and B, if James Gunn would come back, because he had hinted about possibly not returning for the series. So he posted on Facebook this week. He said, "This week we start the U.S. press junket before traveling to Europe at the end of the week. Of course, I know some of the questions that come up a lot. Wasn't there a lot more pressure dealing with the second film?" He says, "No, there's less, because this time I knew there was an audience waiting to see it." He says, "What was it like working with Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone? Daunting and at times overwhelming." He said, "I ran around in my backyard as a kid pretending to be Snake Plissken and John Rambo, so those guys are icons to me." He said, "But the question that comes up perhaps the most is, what's the deal with Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and are you going to direct? Before I was able to honestly answer this, I needed to know it was in my heart what I truly felt called to do. There is a history in Hollywood of haphazard endings to trilogies, and I didn't want to become part of that dishonorable tradition of pretending the third one doesn't exist. I couldn't do it for the money, and I couldn't do it because it was what other people wanted me to do. I needed to do it because it was what I wanted to do. I have never made choices in my career based on anything other than passion and love for the stories and characters, and I didn't want to start now. So after many months of ruminations and discussions, I know the answer. I could save this answer for the first random interviewer to ask me the question during a press junket, but instead I thought I'd share it with the most important people in the Guardiansverse, you, the fans, who have been so incredibly supportive and enthusiastic over the past 5 years. It has moved me to tears on a regular basis. So yes, I'm returning to write and direct The Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. In the end, my love for Rocket, Groot, Gamora, Star-Lord, Yondu, Mantis, Drax, and Nebula, and some other forthcoming heroes, goes deeper than you guys can possibly imagine, and I feel they have more adventures to go on and things to learn about themselves and the wonderful and sometimes terrifying universe we all inhabit." So, that's great news.
That is very good news.
Because you either love The Guardians of the Galaxy or you don't. I love it. It was I can't remember the last time that I went and saw a movie 3 times in the movie theater,
yeah.
But my son to this day still talks about how we went and saw that movie 3 times in the movie theater.
Yep.
It was really, we've seen a lot of superhero movies together. We've watched all the Spider-Man movies together, pretty much all the PG-13 movies. But this one in particular was like his Star Wars.
Yeah, I agree with that part of it.
Yeah.
It definitely had that feel of a lot of fun. And I remember you and I talking about it, saying this must have been what it was like when our dads took us to see Star Wars.
Yeah, it
because
absolutely was.
Your mind was absolutely blown. It was a great movie with a bunch of characters that you didn't really have a lot of familiarity with. But holy cow, every single thing in that movie hit right. Right from opening scene too.
And again, you either like that movie or you don't. I absolutely loved it. And I remember sitting there watching it. Well, you'd probably go back and listen to the episode at the time, but I remember sitting there watching it and thinking, like, this feels like Star Wars.
Yeah.
This feels like a whole new universe. It feels like something new. Yeah. It felt like something different, and it was like better than I could have imagined that they would bring those characters to the screen. So it was awesome. I'm glad he's coming back. I would love to see him finish out the trilogy in the way that he wants to.
Yes.
But I think that that happens after both of the, or is it one film now? Did they put it back to one film, the Avengers, Infinity, blah,
I
blah,
think
blah.
They did. I'm not 100% sure. Film.
So I think it comes after that. So it's not coming for a while, but good to see that he is coming back for that. Now, in other interesting news, Matthew, we talk a lot about Wizard World in the vein of conventions.
Yes.
Right? And a lot of times what we don't really like about them.
Yeah.
And some things, some trends that we don't like to see. But I read an interesting article this week on ICV2 about their financials. Because the last we knew, things weren't looking so good with Wizard World. Well, Wizard World Entertainment cut its operating loss by more than half in 2016, Matthew, but still booked an $8.5 million loss for the year, according to its SEC filings Monday. The company's 10-K report, filed over 2 weeks late, covered a tough year for the company, which brought in a new CEO, had to refinance, and was in court fighting with former executive, apparently Stephen Sheamus. On the operational front, there was considerable improvement. Wizard cut the number of shows it ran from 25 in 2015 to 16 in 2016, with only a $9 million decline in revenue from $22.9 million in 2015 to $22 million in 2016 by raising prices and generating bigger, better events. That brought up its gross margin on the convention business, and with a reduction in expenses, cut the operating loss from $2.9 million in 2015 to $1.2 million in 2016. The big hits to earnings were non-cash expenses and change in fair value related to derivatives, blah, 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 blah. The company still has cash to operate with around $2.9 million in working capital, up from $1.1 at the end of 2015. Wizard World is planning 16 events in 2017, the same as 2016, and hopes to increase its revenues and profitability on that base. The thing that blew me away about that was that there were 25 events in 2015 and that they still did 16 events last year and are doing 16 events this year.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't think there were that many Wizard shows left.
Yeah. Their operating model, I mean, we saw it twice. We saw it with Wizard coming in saying, hey, you've got an established show in your state. We want to buy it from you. We're going to buy the name. We're going to buy the rights, and we're going to do this. We saw it happen in Connecticut, and no show ever came out of it. We saw it happen in New York.
The Big Apple show.
And one show came out of it.
Yep.
And then everybody ended up getting the rights back to use the name. And it was really just a strange, strange, strange set of circumstances. You would always look at the map and be like, how are they still doing Wizard Texas? How are they still doing Wizard Georgia? I know Wizard Philly has always been
that was
a fairly
the big
lucrative
one, right?
Show
like
for them.
That when we first started doing the show in 2006, that was the big one.
Yeah.
Wizard World Philly was like, at the time,
that was
another
like New
York Comic Con, right?
It really was.
And I remember going to that in I don't know if it was 2006, maybe it was 2008 or something like that I went to Wizard World Philly. And it was a big show.
Yeah.
Sony was there with their PlayStation 3. Like, there was big stuff going on. The game developers were there. Tons of creators were there, and it wasn't the model that it later became, which was the old wrestler heavy, model, where this kind of stuff that we used to see at the old Big Apple shows, the model of so many celebrities that became the focus of the show, and comic books really faded, and the game stuff really faded, and it really just became about these celebrity appearances. And to me, that was a trend that a lot of the other shows that we were enjoying going to picked up on. And that wasn't good either.
Yeah.
And so you went through this period of years where you were seeing the same guests recycled at all the shows, and a lot of them were nostalgia plays for old wrestlers or sports figures or stuff like that. It just changed the whole feel of those shows.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is where that brand started to kind of go downhill. But I had no idea they still had 16 events.
Yeah. And the other part is when they were doing them, they're now going and competing against every other show that's coming up. So you throw, like, we talk about the fact that we used to literally have to go to New York City every other month for a comic book show. Now all of a sudden we could throw a rock every month and go to a show within 2 hours driving from us every month. And that has been oversaturated. And the fact that Wizard, I just think, kept looking at the bigger and bigger and more shows, they definitely priced themselves out of out of whatever they were doing.
It was like, it's like when you buy up like .com domains, right?
Yes.
Because you're like, we're going to just buy everything. We're going to buy the rights to every name in every major city around the country so that if we want to do a show there, we'll own it already.
Yeah.
And half the time those shows never came to fruition, yep. but their strategy was basically, we will just own everything.
Yeah.
And then if there's a show that needs to happen in a particular city, we will already have bought out the local competition. We will own that name. And then we'll be ready to go with that.
It was almost
but it backfired on them.
It almost was a WWF move. Like when the WWF in the 80s, and I always bring this up, when wrestling back in the 70s and 80s used to be very regional and everybody had right. their own little thing. So you in the country and Canada probably had 8 or 9 different wrestling leagues
companies,
going
yeah.
on. So you would just filter back and forth and do your thing. And then all of a sudden Vince McMahon came in and bought them all out and just made WWF a worldwide brand. And that's almost what Wizard tried to do, is buy everybody out, become that brand where, you know what, if it's not a Wizard World, it's not a comic show. And they never quite got that because the magazine, which was probably pumping a ton of money in advertising for them, fell apart with the decline of magazines.
Now, the interesting thing is that Reed is kind of the new Wizard.
Yeah.
In that they have done a similar thing, mm-hmm. right? They have now started to build up their portfolios of shows across the country and stuff like that. And you just wonder what the tipping point is for that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because we just got the emails this week about fan verification for New York Comic Con.
And boy, that was a disaster last year.
And it was a disaster last year, right? And so, you know, and I'm not sure if they run the Star Wars Celebration or not. It might be Reed Expo.
I don't think they do.
Not Reed. It might be Fan Expo that runs that. But that's another one, right? So there are still –
Fan Expo is another one that's
– There's a few players now that are trying to be that everything. And I think there's lessons to be learned from Wizard.
Yeah. Yep. And the thing with Fan Expo, they just bought Boston. And the big
right,
thing
that's
for
what
them,
I saw. That's what it
so
was.
So the big thing for like a Fan Expo and for Wizard is that you already have your contacts with the celebrities that you want. You
sure.
can say, look, we're doing 12 shows. Can we get David Tennant for 10 of them?
Yeah.
And you get them and you're all scheduled and you're all set. And it probably makes it a lot easier to do it that way. But you're kind of laying yourself
well, and you
way
can offer big packages
yep.
to those stars, right?
Yep.
Because you can say to a David Tennant, like, we'll give you 6 shows or 7 shows and we'll give you this chunk of money.
We'll guarantee you $50,000
yeah,
for these
right.
shows, and you just got to be there for 2 days.
Right.
So that's what ends up happening, and that's where you're starting to see the smaller shows are coming in and filling in the gaps. Because you think about the guy that has the 50 long boxes of 50-cent comics. He doesn't have a place anymore at New York Comic Con.
Right.
He doesn't even have a place at some of the other shows we go to. But a show like Plastic City, he might have a place for him. You know, that's his market right there, is a smaller show like that.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. So there you go. That's some news, Matthew. Now let's jump into comic books.
Yes.
And as we get into comic books this week, I am going to kick us off with another title that I told myself I wasn't going to buy. And that is X-Men Blue. #1.
I told myself I wasn't going to buy it, and I didn't buy it.
I bought X-Men Blue, X-Men Gold, X-Men Prime, and Weapon X.
You are a sucker.
Bought all the X-Men's, and I bought the Inhumans title as well.
Perfect.
Just to kind of see, because I had bought into the Inhumans versus X-Men event.
Yep.
So then I was like, okay, well, what is the landscape going to look like afterwards? And so X-Men Blue is going to be the time displaced X-Men team. That's a few years ago. I don't even remember when that was, that the X-Men were brought from the past
yes.
into the future, and you got Cyclops back and you got Jean Grey back. And so,
and that was a great series. That was a great series that to me lost it when all of a sudden they tried tying it in with every other X book.
So, the pitch for this one is, fearing a war among mutants was on the horizon, Hank McCoy, the X-Men known as Beast, pulled the original X-Men, including a younger version of himself, forward through time. That's the original story. Now they are trapped here, separated for a while, but now Marvel Girl, Cyclops, Iceman, Beast, and Angel have been reunited and are determined to show the world that they are the heroes they were always meant to be, Matthew. This series is written by Cullen Bunn, art by Jorge Molina and Matteo Bufagini. Colors by Matt Miller, letters by someone named Joe Caramagna.
I've heard of him.
I haven't heard good things.
Heard a lot of bad.
Yeah, heard a lot of bad things about him.
A lot of restaurants are.
So that's your lineup. You've got Iceman, you've got Beast, you've got Angel, you've got Cyclops, you've got Marvel Girl. Angel, however, Hank McCoy, is not in his Blue Beast form. And he apparently has other powers that I didn't know about before anyway. So we're starting off in a Quinjet. And you have Bobby and Hank and Gene and the whole gang is there except for Warren, who is flying outside of the plane. Now, his wings are made of cosmic fire, Matthew.
Interesting. I don't know when that could happen.
I have no idea how that happened, but he's got cosmic fire wings. So they are apparently trying to track down a ship somewhere in the ocean because they've been sent here because there's some bad guys on the ship. Okay, so as we start off, you're seeing a lot of bickering amongst the team on the Quinjet, and you're coming to find out that Jean Grey has been made the leader of this team. And you're not quite clear how that decision was come to, but Scott is used to being the leader,
yep.
And he's not the leader anymore. You have half the team that has a crush on Jean, and they're all arguing with each other over that, but also you have Cyclops, who is bitter that he's not the leader of the team. But they are coming out, and it seems like this is one of their first missions, right? So we are somewhere in the Mediterranean Sea, and you see this giant yacht that's sort of speeding along, and they end up getting off the Quinjet, coming down there, and at first it seems like nobody's there. But Jean does a scan mentally and figures out that the person that they're looking for is definitely there, and that there are other people aboard, and they seem scared. So now the team is going to kick down the door to the main ballroom on this yacht. And as they do, they see Black Tom Cassidy standing there. Hmm. It says thermokinetic blaster, rogue with a brogue. That's how they describe him. And he is there robbing everybody.
Yep.
And so they kick down the door and you have Cyclops immediately fires off an optic blast and Tom blocks it and it goes through the skylight and blows a hole in the ceiling. And so they're all yelling at each other not to hurt anybody because there's actual passengers in there that are getting robbed and they're trying not to cause collateral damage. So there's a lot of like the team figuring out how to work together again and figuring out what the best way is to take this guy out without hurting anybody else. And so as they're kind of going back and forth, they finally get Black Tom cornered and are talking about how he's not so tough and all that kind of stuff. And he kind of says to him, well, did you think I came here alone? And then you hear thump, thump, thump. And coming through the side of the wall is Juggernaut saying, who wants some? And it's a great, it's actually an awesome page where he bursts through the wall like the Kool-Aid man and knocks everybody flying. And you see that he's there. Now, apparently, have him and Black Tom been like a partnership in the past?
I don't know.
Or something like that?
I don't think so.
But it seems like they have a pretty close relationship because they kind of – Juggernaut is doing what he asked to do. And apparently Juggernaut is very upset because he blames Scott for killing Professor Xavier. And he doesn't realize that this Scott is not that Scott. Mm. And so he's going to, you know, beat the crap out of them. So you have Jean who subdues Tom and you have Juggernaut who's chasing them all over the place, chases them up to the top of the yacht. And Iceman sort of makes the ground slick and Juggernaut topples over the side and ends up going down into the ocean. And they think he's all said and done, but then he comes back up. He is taking advantage of the inexperience of the team when Jean's focusing on someone else. He stomps on the floor and sends the floorboards flying and she goes flying. And it comes to a point where Juggernaut is kind of getting the best of them when all of a sudden Beast says, let me try something. And he ends up doing some sort of magical motions with his hands and opens up what looks like a portal to hell. Didn't know that Beast could do that. So all of a sudden these things come up and grab Juggernaut and drag him down there. And Scott's like, Beast, what you just, and he's like, yeah, I saved the day. And he's like, no, what did you just send that guy to hell? And Beast is like, well, I sent him to, where did he send him to? The Savage. Oh, I sent him to Siberia. But he took a detour through hell. And so they're arguing back and forth about how that could possibly happen. Meanwhile, Jean is using every ounce of her psychic abilities to keep the ship afloat because Juggernaut basically punched a hole in it. So they're kind of going back to Madripoor after that and talking about how that job went and kind of processing. And you see when they get back to headquarters that the person that they're reporting to is none other than Magneto.
Hmm.
And he is saying, you know, he said, you know, that's one down. He says, but there are so many more to go. We must be ever vigilant, X-Men. There are threats against mutant kind, comrades who have lost their way, mutants who capitalize on the fears of the populace. You've been chosen, you, the earliest incarnation of Charles Xavier's dream, to ensure that dream becomes reality, and I will guide you. And you see sort of their list of most wanted behind him, and that's how the story wraps up. Then we have a scene that follows Lady Deathstrike, where you see her. Oh, no, it wasn't Lady Deathstrike. It was somebody else. You see a scene where there is a group of people up in the mountains somewhere where they are getting together a posse because the sheriff is talking about somebody who's recently been murdered around there. And they're kind of going through the woods and they're hunting. And this might be the Wolverine one. Yeah, I think it is. Well, it ends up being a story about Wendigo. And you see the Wendigo who is tearing through people. And obviously when you get bit by Wendigo, you get turned into somebody else. And so Wolverine ends up fighting Wendigo and then he sort of disappears and it ends with the sheriff saying, where the heck did everybody go? And so I don't know if there's backstories that are running through all of these, but you see in the Weapon X book that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, sort of what's been going on with Wolverine and what's been going on with some of the other characters there. But the primary X-Men story here, I thought, did a good job of giving you sort of the status quo of the team right now. I like the fact that Magneto is the one that is sort of leading them at this point. You can't tell right now if he's kind of leading them and they don't really know what's going on or if he's legitimately trying to do good here with this particular team. But of the X-Men books that I read of the new stuff, I kind of like this one and it just has a good vibe to it. And the artwork is fantastic and the story is enough to pull you in. And this one, I felt like you did not need to have read a ton of other stuff to understand because you're coming into this young team that is figuring out how to work together again and they have a new mission.
I might have to pick that one up because I did flip through it at the store and it kind of intrigued me a little bit, but I think I'm going to have to pick that one up.
Yeah, and it's kind of what I like about it is that it's before – I just remember Scott like being so miserable.
Yeah.
In every X-Men book that I've read like over the past 10 years. And so this is them younger.
Yeah.
You know?
And riding the ship. So going from your book of a group that traveled in time to a guy that travels in time to another time, and that is Booster Gold – and the Flintstones. So the creative team on this one is Mark Russell is the writer, Rick Leonardi the penciler, and Scott Hanna the inker. So a very solid creative team on this one. Now we start out with Booster Gold, and Booster Gold is in the future, and he's kind of looking back at some of the things that he's done. Now he is somebody that stole a Legion flight ring, flew back in time, and became a superhero in the 80s. So there was always that question that, yes, he may be a hero, but he is kind of a thief and has done some bad things. So he's going through the stuff. He's getting ready to go out on a date, and he's realizing that he does not have any money. So he's trying to hope – he's hopefully going to try to get somewhere cheap with this girl. And he's going through, and you see all the people walking through town. He meets the girl, and in the future that he's living in, there is no actual meat. So they have to order things that are like fake meat. There's also other things in here.
That's a nightmare future.
Yeah. There's also in things in here where there's only like one or two types of meats that are available. So she's ordering and he's looking at the menu going, can't there be anything a little more reasonable price than what we have? And then there's an explosion outside. Somebody runs by the restaurant burning. So he goes outside to see what's going on and you see this alien invasion and it's these lizards that are coming down. They've got these weird spines on their back and they are shooting everybody and they're making a statement about we're here for somebody and we want that person. And if we don't get them, we are going to destroy every one of you. And you see a policeman show up and he puts his hand up and says, hey, you know, I'm a policeman and I order you to. And then he gets electrocuted and killed. Booster grabs his date, throws her in a dumpster and says, you need to stay here till this is all taken care of. Now, the funny part is that you see on the – all these – aliens fighter things that they're flying in, it's a purple circle with half an alien in it. Like you see the top of an alien making some gestures. And as they're coming in and they said, you know, behind me is a fleet of us and we're going to destroy everybody unless we get who we're looking for. And until that person is here, we are going to just start killing everybody. And then Booster Gold shows up. And he zings back because he's got that time bubble. So he zings back in time and he goes back and it says, let's see. So it's 20,000 BC. And as he is swinging through time before he lands, you have an alien that looks exactly like the aliens that just invaded the future. And the alien is saying, hey, people of Earth, I come to give you a world that is a paradise. I'm here to fertilize your land. I am here to do all this great stuff. And all I want from you guys is just your friendship and companionship. That's the only reason I'm here. We're here to help you develop. And then he turns around and he looks up. He goes, what's that? And then Booster's bubble shows up and slices him in half. Hence the half alien that is on the ship of these dudes that came. And he's just like, oh, hey, little help here. And he's pulling out the wreckage and he's trying to find the controls to a space bubble. And he sees Fred Flintstone. He goes, hey, Beefcake, can you help me get this metal out of here? So as he's pulling the stuff, he goes over and he sees Fred and Barney, rides in on the dinosaur, and he puts the stuff down. And he's explaining, hey, I'm from the future. This is my time sphere. I need some power, so I'm going to need like 50 billion gigabytes of power or gigawatts. Where can I plug in? And they're like, yeah, we don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, we can bring you to a scientist friend of ours. So they go see this scientist. He's in the bubble, and they're sticking electric eels on it to try to power it up.
Yeah, no, that's a reasonable solution. Yep.
And he's saying, look, we're a little lost in this one. So then he gets enough power at least to contact a friend of his who's doing some time travel and is in a dinosaur time era too. And he's like, hey, lady, can you maybe help me out? And she's like, oh, Booster, I'm over here. I'm about a century away from you. But what I'll do is I'm going to finish up here and – And as she
I'll swing back and pick you up.
And before she can even finish, Tyrannosaurus chops her in half and bites her and eats her.
Oh.
So he's like, yeah, this isn't very good right now. And as he goes out, you see in the future, he starts reaching out to all of his friends. And he reaches out to a guy who looks like the doctor. And he's like, hey, what year are you in, Doc? And he goes, well, I'm in 79 AD. Why don't you call this guy? So then he calls this guy. And you see this alien, and the alien's name is Krabillion. And he goes, hey, Krabillion, where are you at right now? He goes, well, I'm in the 20th century, and I'm going to a Who concert. So you see him walking in to see the Who. And he's like, all right, well, I got one more call to make. So he calls Alfred, and Batman's butler, and he calls Alfred. And he goes, hey, Alfred, this is Booster Gold. How you doing? He goes, pretty good. What can I do you for? Batman's not here. And he goes, hey, can you just do me a favor? Could you deposit $5 in my account right now? Because I'm in kind of a little bit of trouble. I need to get out of this. And he goes, sure. So the Wayne Foundation will deposit $5 in your name in the First Bank of Gotham. He's like, hey, great. Thanks a lot. Talk to you later. So now he's back in time and he's trying to figure out how is he going to make this ship work. So he's got Fred and Barney and they're building stuff. They're trying to get stuff. Skeets is there. And meanwhile, he's looking into the future and seeing that these aliens have just destroyed the Earth. And they have they're having church, and they have the aliens have on a pike, they've got half the alien, and they're like, this is our God that was destroyed millions of years ago by humanity. We worship you, and we are hoping to make things right. So Booster is now going, all right, well, things are not going well in my future, but I really need to get out there. And the scientist, he's like, so I need. And this is where he tells him, I need a million gigajoules of power. And you see the alien, the scientist in the Flintstone era going, all right, let me make some calculations. It looks like he's on a computer, but he's got an abacus and he's just flipping beads back and forth. He's like, okay, what's a million? And he goes, all right, this is not good. This is not going to work. So you see the aliens now are arguing with each other, and they realize that Booster is somewhere, and they're going to try to find him. But before they could find him, all of a sudden, he shows back up with Fred and Barney into the future. And one of them goes, what the fun? And then all of a sudden, craziness happens. They start fighting. They bring a dinosaur with them. They bring a saber-toothed tiger. All sorts of crazy things go. And all the dinosaurs wipe out the aliens. And one of the things is like he's trying to keep peace. And he's saying, look, we can stop this right now. The cool thing is that I went to the past and I got your leader. And what he does is he has the body, the half body of their leader in a basket. And he pulls him up and he props him up like it's breakfast at Bernie's or Weekend at Bernie's. And he's like, hey, guys, I'm okay. You don't need to fight with these guys. Let's just make this a little bit better and we'll just go back to our planet. And they're like, hey, you sound a little funny. He's like, oh, just the space travel. Don't worry about me. And then all of a sudden, the body flops off of Booster's hand. And they're like, yeah, you are officially now really dead. Prepare to die, all of you. And then all of a sudden, the alien that was at the Who concert shows up and says, hey, guys, let's talk about this before you wipe out the aliens. These humans. Let's just talk about this. Come on my ship. We'll discuss. We'll have an agreement. We'll figure this all out. So then the aliens all take off, and then they have a talk with him. They come back and say, okay, we understand that because of what happened, made our civilization what it is. We're willing to take care of all this, let bygones be bygones, but we're still not too thrilled with you. They all shake hands. They send the Flintstones back to Earth, back to their Earth. And the interesting thing that with the Flintstones comic, I mentioned this before, every other issue has a new god showing up, and they start worshiping a new god. So as they go there, there is a new god that is they're worshiping, and the guy is wearing like the scales of that alien on his head. So that's their headdress. So now it's the future, and Booster's like, hey, things went great. I'm really happy about how everything turned out. And he goes, I'm going to go on my date now because I've now come back a couple hours early. So now there's meat there, by the way. Things are fine.
Yep.
He goes to get money out, and he sees that the $5 that the Wayne Foundation donated into his account in 1980-something has now turned into billions and billions of dollars. So he takes the girl out on the date, and as they're sitting there eating their date – or eating at the date – she orders something, and it's a big rack of brontosaurus ribs.
From the old Flintstones.
Puts it
thing
on the plate, and she's like, I don't think I can eat all this. And then in the back, walking by the restaurant, you see a bunch of monkeys walking by. So to me, that was almost like, hey, you played with past. You may have a Planet of the Apes issue coming on pretty soon. So that was a fantastic story. Another one, you have a bonus feature. It's The Jetsons, written by a couple people we know, Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor.
Nice.
They wrote this one, and Pierre Brado is the artist on this one.
I would read a Jetson series from – is there going to be a Jetson series from
him? I am hoping so, because the art in this is freaking fantastic. The story is Judy ends up going to a place. They're missing Judy. They're trying to find her. They go, and where Judy went is to go see George's mother, who is dying. And in the future, you're not going to die. You are going to have your body uploaded into a robot so you can live forever.
Oh.
And I basically gave you the basic gist of this story. But there were moments in here where I started to tear up when I was reading it, because it is one of those things where you start thinking, wow, we're all going to die, and this is horrible. And then you're thinking, wow, this is kind of a crazy way to keep people back. But there is a lot of humor in it. There is everything, the emotion that you would expect from Jimmy and Amanda with their writing. And it's also – it does say to be concluded in – to be continued in The Jetsons. So I'm hoping we are going to get a Jetsons comic out of this, because between The Flintstones and The Jetsons, I'd love to have my past and my future covered with great comics.
There you go. All right, Matthew. Well, we're going to stick in the X-Men universe, and we're going to talk about Weapon X number one. This book is written by Greg Pak, and if I can find the actual credits somewhere, I will tell you. Oh, here we go. Pencils by Greg Land, inks by Jay Leiston, colors by Frank D'Armata, and of course, Mr. Joe Caramagna doing the letters on this one as well. Now, your cast for this book includes Old Man Logan, Domino, Sabretooth, Lady Deathstrike, and Warpath. And of the X books, this was probably the one that was most potentially exciting for me.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm not a huge Wolverine fan, I like all those other characters. So it says, decades ago, a clandestine military experiment attempted to create the perfect soldier, resulting in various incarnations of superhuman marvels and misfires. In the years since, the bleeding edge science and technology driving the project culminated in the Weapon X program, responsible for the creation of many of the world's most vicious killers and mercenaries. It was thought to have been disbanded.
Uh-oh.
Dun, dun, dun. As we open up this series, you have Old Man Logan, who is sitting in the middle of the forest. And he's thinking, they call me a mutant, a freak of nature. They're wrong about that second part. Me and nature, we get along just fine. And all of a sudden, he looks up and a deer's looking at him, and he sniffs, and he's like, something's going on, because he's got that super strong smell. Lo and behold, who comes wandering by but two lost hikers, Matthew.
Mm.
And the guy's like, oh my God, we didn't think we'd find anyone here. And he says, neither did I. And he says, they smell like fear. So they're saying, oh, we can't get a signal on our cell phone. You wouldn't happen to have a phone that works. And he's like, look, head up the river about 7 miles. You'll hit a bridge. You go west and the trail is another 5 miles. And they're like, oh, that's so great. Thank you so much. And he kind of gives them a smile and they start walking away. And he's like, you know, and he hears him talking. They're saying, oh, that's amazing. You know, saved by a mountain man. And he's like, oh, it was just kids coming through. Got to remember. And before he even finishes that, he gets stabbed through the chest with this giant piece of metal. And he turns around and both the male and female hiker that he just gave directions to, their flesh is kind of peeling off as they turn into like almost like the Terminator 2 guy.
Yeah.
A liquid metal sort of thing. And they start attacking him and they are full on robots. So they start chasing him through the woods. They're screaming, die. He's running away. There's a couple, you know, pages of him running. He ends up jumping into a stream and he cuts a piece of his arm off, like a slab of flesh as big as a steak, and drops it in the water. So they track that instead of tracking him. And he ends up getting away. And one of the robots comes up and says, huh, it's just a piece of him, a decoy. But they take that piece with them. And he, meanwhile, finds a cave and he's having flashbacks to the Weapon X program and everything that happened to him and X-23 and all this other stuff. And you see now at a classified location, because he was just having a flashback about Yuriko, Lady Deathstrike, you see that she's already been captured and she is in some, like a back to tank and she's in there trying to get out. And whoever's on the outside is saying, oh, don't worry about it. That's vibranium glass. She can't break through. But she scratches onto the inside of the glass. Kill you all. So you see these guys and they're in, you know, like biohazard suits and stuff like that. But you see that just brought in was that piece of Logan that he cut off of his arm and they dropped that into another tank. And you see the other tanks are named Warpath and Sabretooth and Domino. So whoever this is either somebody new or perhaps someone who used to be involved with the Weapon X program that is sort of bringing the program back to life. And it seems like they're trying to capture everybody that was involved with the program in the first place. So now back in Washington, you have Wolverine, who I guess we call Old Man Logan now, but it's Wolverine, who is in a library and ends up stealing a motorcycle and is traveling to this cabin in the middle of the woods because he's going to track down Sabretooth. And as he tracks down Sabretooth, the two of them get in a knockdown, drag-out fight because, as you might imagine, Matthew, Sabretooth is not excited to see him.
Yep.
And as they start fighting him, he's like, look, he's like, killer cyborg people using people like skins, they got to me. And it looks like they got to you too because Sabretooth has all these scars all over him. And Sabretooth said, the one that came for me, it was a kid. And so the two of them are saying, okay, so clearly these monsters are after us. And he is talking to Sabretooth and Sabretooth opens his shirt and you see that he was like pretty much gutted and he's still healing back from that. So the two of them sit down and have a bowl of cereal together and they're talking about the fact that apparently someone is now after them. And all of a sudden they hear a sound outside and the whole cabin blows up and now these monsters, these robotic monsters are after them and are trying to kill them here. And that's the way the first issue ends. So Wolverine, Sabretooth, being pursued, Lady Deathstrike already captured. Someone is after all the Weapon X people, and that's the first issue of this book. I really enjoyed it. It was fast-paced. It was action-packed. And for a Weapon X book, that's kind of what you're looking for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this of the X-Men stuff that I've read, although I did enjoy X-Men Blue, this was the one that felt like, okay, these guys got something going on right out of the gate. So I will probably be picking up the second issue of this series and seeing where it goes. I'm not the biggest fan of Greg Land's art.
I know it's an acquired taste. I love it because I love the realism.
Well, and it's very heavily like photo referenced.
Yes.
And so to me, that sometimes feels a little stiff.
Yep.
And the action scenes. But actually, most of the action scenes in here came out really well. So overall, a good first issue.
I think it's an odd choice for a Weapon X book for his art.
For his art? See, yes. I thought he was a very poor match for the Spider-Woman book.
Yep.
That to me just did not work well at all. Here, it feels a little more okay.
So the last one of these team-up books that I'm going to be talking about is the one that I thought probably made the most sense and had the most potential.
Uh-huh.
And I really think that they did a great job with it. And that is Green Lantern, Space Ghost. So I was a huge fan, and I know you've read it too, Brian, the Joe Kelly Space Ghost series that came out a few years back.
Yes.
Where they basically gave him an origin. Now, Ariel Olivetti did the art in that one.
He's amazing.
Amazing job. So he is back to do the art in this one, and it's written by James Tynion the fourth, I should say. 1V is 4. And Christopher Sabella. They're the writers of this one. And you start out with Green Lantern going to a dead planet at the end of the universe. This is the end of the known universe. This is where it ends. There's a dead planet, and they're receiving a distress signal about a weapon. And Green Lantern goes over there. Now, he's in contact with the core, and he's there. And he's like, look, this is a husk. This can't be the world that you want me to save. I don't get it. This is already a destroyed planet. And they're saying, well, there's some life here. Something's going on, and you need to find out. And then all of a sudden, off camera, you hear, mine, and you turn the page. Larfleeze shows up. And the two of them have a huge battle because he is answering the same call.
Mm.
Now, he is an Orange Lantern. So he is there. He is angry. And he is just like, it's mine. This is all mine. You know, you don't need to be here. You shouldn't be here. The call I received, they have a weapon. I need to take care of this. And as they're starting to fight, there's another image that's showing up. But it's not an image that he can see. You see kind of an outline of something. And Hal is like, show yourself. If you can hear me, you need to send backup. I got something really weird here. And then all of a sudden, you see the ghost outline of Space Ghost. And he's like, you're going down. So then Hal's like, look, I know you seem hurt right now, but do you see what I'm seeing? And Larfleeze is kind of like, my weapon. I need the weapon. And he goes, look, that's all you've been talking about. Right now, you just take care of your greedy little self and get out of here. And then all of a sudden, a zap hits him, and these bugs start to show up and attack him. And Lantern's like, what is going on? And as he is now caught, he puts himself in a sphere, surrounds himself, and all these bugs start to attack him. So he makes a big fly swatter, starts attacking him. And then he realizes that the person he's fighting is stronger than he thought. And it isn't a lantern, so he can't just, you know, use his reputation to battle him. And he realizes that he's fighting Space Ghost. They start talking. He's like, I don't even know who you are. And he's like, look, I'm Space Ghost, and I am the policeman in this sector. I am here to take care of a problem, and you are the problem. So because everybody's getting a message that there's a weapon. They just know that there's a weapon. So all of a sudden, Green Lantern's like, I can't focus. I don't know what's going on. And as he starts to lose consciousness, he starts to fall into this planet. Space Ghost grabs him before he can fall. He puts a sphere on him, and they crash, and they land in the woods. And now they're on this planet, and you look and see that surrounding Green Lantern is this huge mech army. And he's like, hey, take me to your leader. And he's like, fine, I'm Hal Jordan. I'd received a distress call about this planet. Was this you? And he goes, there's nobody sending a distress signal. Right now, you're here. And they have these huge weapons. It's like very 80s looking with the mech and these big muscle dudes with the big weapons. And they're like, I don't know why you're here, but you're here and you're not supposed to be. So we're going to take care of you. And he's like, look, calm down. I'm just here to help. And he's like, I'm here for some kind of weapon. And the guys that are looking at him go, you're the weapon. You're here for the weapon to steal because you're just nothing but a weapon. And then they're like, look, wipe it away before it spreads. So all these robots circle around him. They get ready to fire. And he creates a scary image in space to scare him away, which ends up being Batman. And they all run away. So now he's there, and he's in the woods kind of like, I don't even know where I am. I don't know what just happened, but that is not really good. So then Space Ghost shows up, and Hal's like, seriously, can't you just – not creep up on me and tell me what's going on. So the two of them start to fight for a little bit. Great action sequence. And then as they start to fight, they turn around and they see a mech walking towards them. And as the mech walk towards them, there's a young girl leading them saying, hey, you're not supposed to be here. And he's like, what are you doing here? And she goes, well, they think I'm all sleeping. I want you to come, and I want you to talk to my uncle or my grandfather. And he says, her name is Kella, and I'm not a bad guy, but I want you to help kill the bad guys. And then she goes, are you the bad guys? And they're like, well, we're not the bad guys. So the two of them are tied up, and they go and they meet with these people, and these people all come out. And you see an older man who's sort of in charge of this group, and he comes out and says, Hal's like, are you the person that said something about a weapon, that you sent a weapon out? I come to this dead planet. you know, am I too late? And he goes, oh, no, you're not. You must have misunderstood the message. I'm not talking about a weapon. I need help to finish my weapon. You must have not got all the transmission. And he goes, where are you from anyway? And in their sky, there's no stars. So they don't even think about life on any other planet other than just their own. So they go in there and they see this weapon. And you see that he's created a weapon to fight the other guys on this planet. So they're in the middle of this huge war. And Hal and the Space Ghost need to stop these guys from destroying themselves. And they realize that the people they're with right now, this old man and the young girl, are the good people. They're just trying to create a weapon to save themselves. This other group just wants to wipe them out and enslave them. So as they're trying to fight, their Hal's ring is not necessarily working like it should. So they say, why don't we kind of team up with our weapon? So Hal creates another ring to give to Space Ghost. Space Ghost gives Hal sort of the amulets that he wears on his on his wrists. So the two of them are trying to work each other's weapons. And what is really cool is you've got a moment where Hal is trying really desperate to work these things. And Space Ghost is saying, wow, this ring, it burns my body every time I use it. Does this happen to you? And he goes, yeah, but you start to compensate for it. And you start hearing Space Ghost say all these things about the ring that you never thought of. Like, this is like in my brain. I don't understand how you can make this work. Seeing all the things that how this ring works, it isn't just point and shoot. There's a lot to it that really works at your soul, which I really liked about that one. But as they're starting to work this and they're trying to get ready to fight the bad guys, there's an explosion that happens. They hear it. They see what goes on. They go into the place and they find the old man is dying. And there's a really touching moment. And what I really liked about this was it definitely seemed more than the other ones to go back and forth between you're reading a DC comic and now you're reading Hanna-Barbera something. So in this moment, you've got this old man that's dying and he's looking at you know, the young girl's like, well, what are we going to do? You know, I don't want him to die. And he's like, all my dreams, all I've ever wanted was to live in a universe of possibilities. I know I'm dying and it's sad that I'm never going to see the stars that you've talked about. So Hal brings him up into space. And as he's up there, he's like, wow, it's gorgeous. Thank you. And then he dies. And then they leave his body up there so he can float among the stars forever. And they go back down. And then each one of them go to certain groups and say, look, you've got to stop your fighting. This isn't going to work. This isn't very good. The people there are like, you know, the people that were wanting to understand are like, yeah, we don't want to fight. We just want there to be peace. Then they go to the warlike group and say, can you guys stop your fighting? You need to stop this. You need to stop this right now. And they say, okay, we agree only with you guys. We'll agree. So then Hal and Space Ghost go up in space. They say goodbye. And the last page you see is that the warlike people are starting to look at some of their mech. And they've now changed the insignias that they have to a half-side Green Lantern and a half-side Space Ghost logo. So you're seeing that they're kind of looking at them going, huh, we're going to be like those guys. We're going to make the weapons like they had so we can take over things. And it says the beginning. So a really, really, really good story. I love the story that was there. I love the art. I love the interplay between the two. And then you have another shocker of a group. Now, Rough and Ready were a couple, was a dog and a cat. And I don't remember them very much, but they're pretty crazy. They've got some silly moments. One of them looks like a droopy dog and the other one's kind of an orange cat. But the funny thing about this one is that if you're going to have a Hanna-Barbera property really just amped up, why not have Howard Chaykin do it?
Sure.
So Howard Chaykin wrote and drew it. And it's a really good story, but it takes place in the 50s within like a 50s-style TV series. So a lot of fun, a lot of weirdness. And Howard, again, he's one of those guys that every time he does something, you're more curious as to what he's going to do to it. And I thought he did a great job with it. He definitely amped up the violence in it, not necessarily the sexual aspect that he tends to play with. But when these two things start punching each other, there's blood everywhere. So it is a really fun story. Again, these books have all been great. There's one I didn't get, and it was Future Quest and somebody else. So I might have to go back and get this one because I got three, and all three of them were fantastic.
All right, Matthew. Well, that brings us to our creator spotlight for this week, Mr. Jeffrey Edwards. Now, in the last episode of Secret Identity, we talked about Extermination in our Out of the Long Box, which was a series that he did the art for. He is now the artist on the upcoming Warlock 5 revival. And again, by the time this gets posted, I will probably have the issues of the original series that I bought on eBay. So I will be doing an out of the long box on that. But I was excited to kind of connect with him about bringing a series back that probably has a pretty strong cult following, but a lot of people probably aren't familiar with. So here's your Creator Spotlight this week. And that is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. For Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week. And we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, and this is Brian here, and today I am joined via the interwebs by Jeffrey Edwards, the artist on the upcoming Warlock 5 series. How are you today, sir?
I am doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing great, man, and it's so funny because when I was speaking to the folks at Ragnarok Publications about this new series, and we'll get into Warlock 5 in a minute and sort of what that series is all about and what people can expect from it. And I saw that you were the artist on that book. I was like, where do I know that guy's name from before? And it was from a series that you did for Boom that you worked on in, I think it was like 2012 is when it came out, which was called Extermination. And it was a series that I remembered reviewing on the podcast and actually went back. And there was a couple different episodes that we had talked about that because it was a great series. So I knew you from somewhere, and then I saw that and I was like, oh yeah, now I can't wait to talk to this guy. So so maybe a good place to start would be, how did you end up getting involved with Boom Studios back in 2012 and working with Cy Spurrier on Extermination?
Well, it's pretty much your basic story of meeting somebody at the right place at the right time. I went to C2E2 in 2012. It was my first time going. I was just blown away by how cool the show was. It was probably the biggest show I ever gone to. And these two gentlemen come up to my table just like any other time, and we're talking, and they basically just asked me if they can look at my portfolio. I give them the portfolio of pages that I brought in case I wanted to get it reviewed or maybe try to land a job. And I get asked to look at, I get people that had asked me to look at my portfolio a lot. So I didn't really think too much of it. I handed it to them. I'm still working on commissions. And then they were like, oh, we really like what you're doing. And oh, by the way, we're the editor in chief and his assistant of Boom Studios. So I jumped right up and I was like, oh man. And I shook the hands and I, you know, just got to talking, and they were great guys. And long story short, because I could talk for hours, they basically had a contract waiting for me before the end of the weekend. I come home, it's right there, and they were fantastic about it. I sent a couple sample pages just so that they could see basically how fast I could produce the artwork, and I landed the job. I got a script from Cy maybe 3 days later, tops. And I hit the ground running, man. I just took off and did it. Met my editor-in-chief, the editor on the book, Eric Harburn, through just basically like Basecamp. And then he told me that Blonde the Colorist was coloring the book. And so, of course, I got even more excited because I was yeah, you know, you have this top-tier writer, top-tier colors, and I just hope that I don't screw it up. So, yeah, that's it, man. I was just in the right place at the right time.
And we actually just talked about, I went back to talk about the first issue of that series on our last episode of the podcast, just to sort of refresh people's memory. But if they're not familiar with it, it was, what I liked about that series is it basically took place after the alien invasion had already happened and the world was kind of somewhat post-apocalyptic, and you had essentially a Batman-like figure and then kind of a Dr. Doom-ish, you know, like figure slash Doc Ock that had to team up together, basically the arch nemesis, to battle this interdimensional, very sort of cosmic Lovecraftian sort of race that had sort of taken over the world. And I just loved that twist on it. Like, it was fantastic. And your artwork was amazing in the book because the creature design was very much something out of a Lovecraft story. And so between your designs for those creatures and the colors by Blonde, as you mentioned, that really gave it this very ethereal feel when you were dealing with the aliens. Like, there was, that stuff appealed to everything that I love because I'm a huge Lovecraft fan.
Well, when I was told at first that this is what we're looking for, we're looking for monsters that you'd never seen before, but felt relatable to that sort of umbrella term, Lovecraftian. And so I said, well, what can we do? I've been given references, so they had given me some good starting points, but I kind of wanted to just make it crazy. I don't often get to work with such star power like Blonde, the colorist. So a lot of times when I'm doing the line art for crazy monsters or characters, I don't really trust as much as I maybe did on this book, because I knew I could just sit there and say, look, I'm going to draw something wild and he's going to kill it. And he did. And then when we got more involved with the books and we did the second book, we had more conversations with back and forth. And I said, hey, you know, I want this to be nuts. I want this to be crazy and memorable. And he was right there with me. So it was great that I could take and sort of tap into the crazier side of comic books. Cause you know, you draw big muscly men punching people in their face enough. And then you get the opportunity to draw an alien invasion. And why would you hold back? You know? So it was a lot of fun. And anytime I can jump into a story where I can really sink my teeth into it and get the opportunity to draw something a little bit different than the capes and the heroes, it's a nice break. Don't get me wrong. I grew up loving Wolverine, Spider-Man. You know, my favorite character is a character called Darkhawk. So that's always got a place in my heart, but it's being able to do something different. And then somebody trusts you enough to say, yeah, man, go crazy with it. So it was great. It was great.
Well, and I think that's a great segue to the book that we're going to talk about now, because when I saw that you were doing Warlock 5, which is actually, as we speak now, as people listen to this interview, the Kickstarter is up and they can go to our show notes and find a link to the Kickstarter for Warlock 5. But this Warlock 5 book, when I saw that it was announced, when I saw that you were working on it with Cullen Bunn, and then I saw sort of what the premise was, to me, like as a kid who grew up in the 80s, you know, I'm in my early 40s now, so I grew up in the 80s watching basically all of the kinds of movies that go into Warlock 5, and I never realized that there was a series that was put out in the 80s by Aircell Comics that involved sort of these five guardians of different dimensions that were overseeing sort of the nexus of all reality. And so when I knew I was going to be talking to you, I went to eBay and I actually bought the entire first run of those comics and have been digging into them. And this is like a mashup of every awesome fantasy, sci-fi, and horror movie that I watched growing up. Like, how excited were you to jump into this universe?
Oh man. So, okay. If you're not familiar with Cullen Bunn, he is top tier level talent writing for Marvel, but I didn't know he was going to be writing this book when I signed on to do the book. I had only been told the premise of the original story, and that alone was enough for me to say, yes, yes, please. Yes. Whatever we have to do to make this happen, because you're absolutely right. I mean, everything from the artificial intelligence that's both detached and at the same time has that detached wit to it. You got monsters like shape-shifting dragons. You got knights from the medieval era. You've got zombies. You've got magic. You've got everything. And it was all right there in this little synopsis that was given to me. And I said, dude, where do I sign? This is fantastic. I what could I want in a story that isn't here? I mean, you have this core group of characters that are crazy. They're from vastly different backgrounds with crazy powers, and they don't like each other a lot of times. And that's great too, because you don't have that sort of buddy cop play out. You have one of them's ready to tear the head off of the other one constantly. And it's just, it's so good. And then, of course, Jeremy, he's like, oh, and by the way, Cullen Bunn is a hardcore fan and he's writing the script. And I was like, oh man, yes.
Him and Jimmy Johnston are yes. working on that together. And you mentioned, you know, you have these group of five guardians that sort of don't like each other's in the story possibility that, that sort of comes out of that. I read when I was reading the first couple issues of that series, they hated each other. And so basically, yeah. you know, as the guardians of these different realities, they were all aware of how much power one of them could have if they got rid of the other four. And in sort of overseeing all of reality. And so you have this pull of this immense power that some of the team is very sort of altruistic and doesn't necessarily think that way. And then others very much think like, this could just be all mine. I could just kill the rest of these guys. And my favorite character by far so far has been Zania, who is the sort of necromancer and machine gun wielding cyberpunk villainess from this other dimension. Like, I just loved her character from the second that I saw it. And it was like watching a heavy metal video. And as a metalhead, like every panel that she was in, I could almost hear the soundtrack for.
Absolutely. Oh man. When I was handed the original designs and, we had kind of played back and forth with, I don't want to say redesigning, but sort of just, adding my touch to it and making it a little bit more, a little less caught in the 80s and a little bit more timeless. There was a couple of characters that really, really stood out for Cullen. It was Savishtar. He absolutely, absolutely loves that character. And I totally understand. So I really wanted to give him what he wanted with the, as far as the overall look of the character. And that was basically don't do much. He looked fantastic before, leave him alone. But me, I gravitated to Zania. Absolutely. First thing, I was like, the chick's got a mohawk. She walks around with these guns and a whole horde of zombies that basically she is like the general of. She is a total, and you know, I grew up with reading comics with characters that had strong females as the lead. Wonder Woman's my favorite. I know everybody loves Wonder Woman, but I love Wonder Woman. Back when I was a, you know, 10-year-old kid sitting on the floor in my local comic book shop reading comics, I love to be able to jump into a story and be able to say, look, this story has a female lead that is, she could go toe-to-toe with any of the guys or the, you know, the walking tank, the robot Argon. I love Zania. And so when I got to do the designs for her, there was a few things that I wanted to throw in there. They had tattoos in the design in the first one, so I said, well, why don't we give her something that a lot of times you see nowadays is full arm sleeves. And so they went for it. So I've got full arm sleeve tattoos. She's got her mohawk. She's my favorite. Anytime I get to draw, I mean, I love drawing all the characters, but especially when I get to draw her in a panel, oh man, it's so good. It's so good. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, and it sort of reminded me of Return of the Living Dead Part 2, right? Because that's one of the things I loved about revisiting the old series is that I could just almost feel the 80s B-horror movie vibe that just ran through all of it. You know, like movies like Hardware and like I said, Return of the Living Dead Part 2 and all of that kind of stuff. And then when you mix sword and sorcery with it, you know, you mention the shape-changing dragon, then you have the sort of night lord. I mean, just all of that stuff kind of thrown together. It's like this cosmic sandbox of every genre mashup that you could imagine. And these are the people responsible for like protecting all of reality, which is just what a great premise.
Absolutely. I mean, I could not have said it better myself. That's exactly what you have. You have these characters that you almost want them to, you almost want them just to fight each other out, just because you know that if one character did take over all of the grid, what would happen if it was Zania? The potential, you know, the possibilities are endless. Or if it was the Argon, the the killer robot that basically has this entire world of other minion robots. What if he, you know, actually got control of the entire grid and killed off the rest of the warlocks? I mean, or if it was Tanith, she's a sorceress from a frozen world, an ice world. She's an ice queen. What if she was the one that got, you know, it is just the possibilities are endless when you take and you basically tap into, as you said, everything that you and I grew up watching and reading is in the book. And I just love it. I can't tell you. I get up every day loving what I'm doing. I really do.
And we're sort of just at the beginning of it, right? Because the Kickstarter has just gotten underway. I haven't even had a chance to sort of see like what the stretch goals are or what the incentives are or anything like that. What can you talk about in terms of the Kickstarter and the plans you guys have for this? Because you're basically reviving, I think, a cult classic.
Yes. Well, as far as the Kickstarter goes, we're still not able to talk too much about it as far as who's gotten what and the donors. But what I can say is that we are we're basically opening up the entire Barry Blair library as a potential donation milestone. The whole purpose is to fund a 60-page graphic novel. And one of the things that we're doing is, depending on when this airs, Planet Comic Con is a local comic convention to all of us, and we had an exclusive 18-page floppy comic book that we had at the show. If everything works out, it will have worked out. So things like that. We want to get people. If I recall correctly, one of the milestones is I would actually draw you into the comic book if that was approved. We've been tossing ideas back and forth between the team, because there's like a dozen people on the team, and we're just spitballing ideas all the time at this point in the development of the Kickstarter. So it's kind of back and forth right now.
Yeah, it's kind of still organic.
Yeah, because we all have so many ideas, and we only have so many milestones that we really want. I mean, we don't want to have 1,000 milestones out there, but yeah. So it's stuff like at one point if we had the Kickstarter earlier, we were going to have a dinner with the entire creative team at Planet Comic Con, and if you donated enough to cross that milestone, we'd all hang out at dinner, stuff like that, fun stuff. So, but it's kind of still back and forth at this point in time.
Well, and people can go now and check out, you know, what at least the early stretch goals are and things like that.
Right.
The Kickstarter. And so what I like about it is that you guys are also celebrating the whole series. You know what I mean? That it's a celebration of sort of what came before as well, and the original creators and stuff like that, which I think is really cool, because that series is, man, when you go back and look at the covers and you look at the character designs, like, there's so much iconic stuff in that, and to see it being celebrated for what it was, but also you guys bringing it back now to the forefront and saying we also have sort of plans for these characters, I think is super exciting. And it's a property I didn't know anything about until I saw this project, and it blew me away.
Yeah, I mean, it would be like if somebody said, we're going to hand you, you know, the original Superman story, and you would have to respect and revere the work that had been done. And if they said, we trust you with it, don't screw it up, that's, you know, that's the task at hand right now. And because as soon as I got onto the project, I was just like you. I hadn't read the books beforehand. I was given all the books. I read them all. They're fantastic. So I want to do nothing to take away from the hard work that was put into these books originally. I'm just trying not to screw it up, basically. but yeah, I mean, we want to be able to be fans of the original work first but then also say, within that box that has been created, where can we take this? Because it's like the story cut short too soon. You know, we're like, where could this have gone? Where, if somebody could pick up the mantle and take this story forward, where would it go? Where's one of the millions and of optional, you know, options of story? Where can this go? And so far, I've been doing comics for a few years now, and I haven't been asked to do quite as crazy a things in comics as I have here. I mean, just in the first 15 pages, I've been asked to do 3 double page splashes of immense scenes and crazy moments, and I mean, so it's not, there's no kid gloves either. There's no, we want to tiptoe through the tulips. We're going to take the story. We're going to be true fans, and as true fans, say, this is one direction we're going to go with it, and we're going to give it 100%. So there's no pulling punches. It's so much fun. Oh man.
I cannot wait to check out this book when it comes out. And the good thing is I have the old ones to sort of make my way through and get myself up to the point that it was before. And as I mentioned, people can go on our website and check out the link to the Kickstarter right now. We'll obviously be talking about it on the podcast as the Kickstarter goes on and as you guys get a little bit farther down the road. And people can go to the Ragnarok Publications website to learn more about it. But if people wanted to find out what's new with you and what projects you're working on or sort of what's going on with shows that you might be going to, where's the best place for them to catch up with you online?
The very best place would be probably my Instagram. I was a little late to the whole Instagram party, so I've only had my Instagram for like 4 months, but it's fantastic. I talk with everybody possible on my Instagram. So it's Jeffrey Allen Edwards Jeffrey Allen Edwards at Instagram. And if you want to actually be able to look at a large portfolio of my work, I have a DeviantArt page. So it's Jeffrey Edwards Illustration at DeviantArt.com.
Well, I will put links to both of those in the show notes for this one so people can check you out on Instagram and go check out your gallery as well. I have been to your gallery on DeviantArt, and it's awesome, so people can definitely go there. That's where I actually saw early posts about the extermination stuff. So people should definitely go back because there's stuff going back years to things that you've worked on. But I really appreciate you taking the time today to talk about Warlock 5, and it's a series that I'm very excited about, and I can't wait to learn more about. So we'll definitely check in the future, but good luck with the Kickstarter campaign, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for putting this together today. I've had a blast talking with you, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again sometime soon.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.